We saw a singularity theorem, a cosmological singularity theorem, one specific one. Today, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about cosmological singularity theorems, and then let's have some fun with black holes and their singularity theorems. I won't say much about the singularity theorems, but just the basics, just reviewing a little bit about black holes and what you would need if you wanted to pursue singularity theorems there. So more on singularity theorems. Let's assume that a set of symmetries of matter and space-time has been chosen, and assume that an exact solution, or at least its asymptotic properties at early times, have been found. And you can assume that because really we do have quite a number of solutions, and we have quite an amount of information about asymptotic properties of solutions, even if they are not explicitly known themselves. Then again, we choose a time-like congruence of geodesics. And from what we did in the previous lecture, we can now calculate in such circumstances exactly what this bundle of geodesics is going to do, what this congruence of geodesics is going to do. We can explicitly calculate the twist, note that they would rotate like that, the shear, that they would do something like this, and the expansion or shrinkage of a bundle of geodesics along the congruence. So what I'm aiming at is what can happen, or what might have happened at the Big Bang, may have been much more complicated than simply an explosion. It could have been different kinds of singularities. So to see that, let us look at what is called the Hubble functions. Ordinarily, we think of the Hubble parameter that tells us what the acceleration rate is at the moment. But what if the acceleration rate is not the same in all directions? What if we have shear on top of expansion as well? So the Hubble functions. So let us now consider the situation where the universe is expanding, or looking backward in time, shrinking at possibly unequal rates in different directions. It turns out that this is not something that is described easily, because the expansion in one direction is not independent from the expansion in another direction. The Einstein equations link all the degrees of freedom of curvature to each other in a nonlinear way. Remember that the expansion in one direction, in principle, is independent, has an independent degree of freedom from the expansion in any other direction. They are nonlinearly coupled, but in principle, we have to measure them all independently. They're all independent degrees of freedom. When we consider now shear, which we have neglected so far, when we consider now shear, then shear also allows space-time or the geodesics to either diverge away from each other or shrink towards each other, but in such a way that overall there's no change in the volume of our congruence. So that's why I said earlier that when we have shear, it means that a circle of geodesics would go into an ellipse, and if in one axis it is widened, in the other direction, in the orthogonal direction, it has to be narrowed. So let us now define a refined version of expansion, which includes not just the traceful part of the symmetric part of the B matrix. Remember, the B matrix was what governed the evolution of neighboring geodesics away or towards each other. And we split off the anti-symmetric part, and we showed that, we argued that, with a suitable choice of coordinates, you can make that anti-symmetric part, these local Lorentz transformations, go away. Then we are just left with the symmetric part. And it was decomposed into the shear matrix, and which is traceless, and the expansion, which is scalar. Now let us consider the full symmetric part. It was obtained by applying the projection operator onto B, which projects onto just the spatial parts. It turns out that theta mu nu is fully space-like, and it is symmetric. And because it is fully space-like, it can be diagonalized. So what I'm saying is that there is a suitable basis, suitable coordinate system, such that the theta mu nu takes this form. It is diagonal, and its only non-diagonal terms and non-zero terms on the diagonal are the space-like ones. So this tensor always takes, can always be put into this form, and then theta 1 gives us the expansion in the first direction, theta 2 in the second direction, theta 3 gives us the expansion in the third direction. If these numbers are positive, we have expansion. If they're negative, we have shrinkage. Shrinkage meaning geodesics approach each other. This term contains both shear and the traceful part. Now the trace of it, the theta itself, is just, well, the trace of this, it's just the sum of theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3. So in particular, if theta, the overall expansion, is 0, then the trace, the sum of theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, has to be 0, which means that if we have expansion in some directions, in the other directions, we must have shrinkage. Now let us define Hubble parameters, HI. And these Hubble parameters, or Hubble functions, are now defined not as overall expansion rates, but as expansion rates with respect to particular directions. So the H1 is, by definition, the theta I in the one direction, and similar with the two and the three directions. This factor of 1/3 comes about because of some normalization condition. It has to do with the fact that the trace of the projector onto the space-like directions is 3. So the H without the index is the H that we would normally use in cosmology. It is telling us the expansion rate of the universe, now not expressed as the scale factor in the metric, but re-expressed as 1/3 of the expansion. See, whether you look at the scale factor in the metric or the rate at which geodesics drift apart, it amounts to the same thing. They can be reformulated in each other. This would be the Hubble parameter for an FRW spacetime. But we are no longer assuming this much symmetry. We are allowing for spacetime to expand in different directions at different rates. And so we have Hubble parameters for each of the three directions. And they are, by definition, 1/3 of the expansion in the particular direction. So how does it relate exactly to the scale factors then? See, you can use those Hubble parameters to define these expansion rates, and the usual definition would be like an A dot over A. That's just the H without a specification of direction. But if we make it L dot I over Li, then we get those directional Hubble parameters. So it's all pretty simple. We simply have not just one Hubble parameter, we have three now, because of three space directions. And then we can ask, what about those singularity theorems? They predict that there will be a singularity, that there was a singularity in the past. But what kind of singularities could they be? And it turns out that examples have been found, explicit solutions have been found of the Einstein equations, which have a Big Bang singularity, but not of the kind where you suddenly just have an expansion and you get an FRW space-time growing with a scale factor A, but instead, explicit solutions of the Einstein equations are known where you have these three scale factors that nonlinearly behave and that nonlinearly affect each other, where you could have that for a while, for example, the third direction is expanding dramatically, and then it pulls along the first or the second direction, which then slow down the first direction, and then it goes into some oscillations, and all of that stuff can happen because it's highly nonlinear. But you can also study the asymptotics towards a singularity. And explicit examples are known for these types of singularities. In particular, the first case would be where all of those scale factors, remember L stands for A, the Li are the three scale factors for the three directions, three spatial directions. If all of these three go to zero, then it's just like in a Friedmann-Lemaître Robertson-Walker space-time. It's just everything shrinks. And that's how the singularity is approached. But it is also possible that there's only two out of the three scale factors actually go to zero at the past cosmological singularity. Now imagine how that looks like when two scale factors go to zero, but the third one might actually go to infinity. So what that means is that the space-time is it's like in two directions, it shrinks, but in the third direction, everything expands actually. It's like a big rip in one direction, but it's like a big crunch in the two other directions. And that would be what is called a cigar singularity. You can also have that in two directions, in two dimensions, I mean, in two independent directions, the scale factors go to zero. And in the third direction, the scale factor goes to a constant. In this case, in two dimensions, you have a shrinkage, you go back to a big bang, but in the third direction, it is just a finite length. And that would be called a barrel singularity. You can also have that the scale factors, two scale factors, approach a constant, and only in the third direction do we have that everything gets crushed. In this case, it would be a pancake singularity. Obviously, these space-times are not isotropic at all. Right? It depends in which direction you look. Some directions expand, some shrink, some expand or shrink infinitely, and some just finitely. And these are just a few of the possibilities. These are possibilities for which explicit solutions are known. Right. Any questions about cosmological singularity theorems? Because if not, then I thought I'd move on now to black holes. Okay. All right. Let's do a bit about black holes now. So it was in 1915 that Schwarzschild came up with the black hole solution. And that's the Schwarzschild black hole in the Schwarzschild coordinates. And of course, you know that it has a singularity at r equal to 0. It's a curvature singularity. And we have a horizon at r equal to 2m, where this thing blew up. It took decades to figure out that this is just a singularity of the coordinate system, but it's not a singularity of the space-time. It's just a bad choice of coordinate system. Really, the curvature and every other physical quantity is fine across the horizon. Now, however, and that has to do with singularity theorems, as we'll see in a moment, it is important that there's a sign change across r equal to m. Namely, right, you see that as r crosses 2m, this changes sign, and that changes sign. But that means that the signature here changes, and whereas this may have started out negative and that positive, they would change roles. Which means that inside the horizon, the t variable shouldn't be thought of as a time at all. Because inside the horizon, dt squared has the opposite sign. And so it actually becomes a space-like variable, whereas r should be thought of as time inside the horizon because it is time-like. So in particular, this vector dt is space-like inside the horizon, and dr is time-like inside the horizon. So let's consider now, for example, a traveler, let's say her name is Alice, who is an explorer and wants to see how it looks like when you fall into a black hole. So let's say Alice starts out at a position r0. That's the radius. That's the radial distance. So we are using a spherical coordinate system. So let's say Alice starts out at r0. And her trajectory is free fall. So she's just freely falling on a geodesic into the black hole. And she has no angular velocity either. So it's just a radial free fall without any angular motion. Then it turns out that in the Schwarzschild coordinate system, her path looks like this. So as time passes, that's Schwarzschild time, and this is the radius, Alice will initially travel in a fairly normal looking way. But then as she approaches the horizon, she is shooting up that singularity here. And she will never ever arrive anywhere there, because this goes all the way up to infinity. So it takes infinite Schwarzschild time for her to travel that part of her trip all the way to infinity. Because as the radius diminishes here towards the horizon, the Schwarzschild time goes to infinity. But then, after an infinite amount of Schwarzschild time has passed, she comes back. She comes back from up here, and her trajectory continues like this. Notice that Schwarzschild time runs backwards for her now. But remember, that's not a concern because dt is space-like now. That's a space variable here. When you are on this side of the horizon, you can travel forward and backward in Schwarzschild time because it's space-like. It's like traveling left or right. Not a problem. What would be impossible is to turn around and go that way. You see, here, this is radius. Alice has the option to go this way or that way. Not a problem. Because it's space. She can go left or right. Here, she cannot. Because that's r here is the time-like variable. And this is the future direction. That's the past direction. So it's not a matter of not having the engine power to turn around and get out of the black hole. It's a matter of the signature of the metric having changed. That's why she can't come out. Her future light cone, her future directed light cone is pointing this way. So for her, going left or right means going, hitting here or hitting there, the axis of r equals 0, but not being able to turn around. Because that's time now. This direction is time. And that direction is space. Well, and then eventually she hits the singularity there at r equal to 0. Let's see what the actual curves are. For example, does it take her an infinite amount of time to get there? According to her own wristwatch? Not really. Let us look at Alice's time. Her proper time, as measured on her wristwatch, is tau of alpha. Alpha, I just used alpha as a parameter to parameterize this geodesic here. So I'm giving you here the formulas for the radius as a function of the parameter alpha. Remember, alpha is not anybody's time. Alpha is just a parameter. So R of alpha and T of alpha, these two curves, I mean, these two functions describe that exact curve here, as alpha runs from 0 to pi. So for example, let's say alpha is 0. Then we have 1 plus cosine of alpha, which is 2. Right? Cosine of 0 is 1. So we have r naught divided by 2 times 2, so that's r naught. That's the initial position of Alice. So r of parameter value alpha equal to 0 is r naught. Right, and so here we have r as a function of alpha, t as a function of alpha. You can do a contour plot now. You can do a 2D plot now with your software, and then you get that type of graph here. There is a variable in here, w, that I need to explain. W is r0 divided by 2m minus 1, square root of it. You know, that's this factor that comes up all the time in Schwarzschild, in the Schwarzschild solution. So let's just give it a name, w, to make those formulas look a little simpler. Here's the w, there's the w, here's the w. Okay, so now if we look, for example, at the proper time of Alice, as the parameter runs from 0 here to pi over there, we have that the parameter alpha runs from 0, in which case we have that this is 0, runs from 0 all the way to pi plus sine of pi, which is 0. So it all runs all the way to pi. So that's the time that it takes her. And if you notice, what happens is that the sine, as alpha runs from 0 to pi, the sine starts at 0, goes up to 1, and then goes to 0 again. But overall, it's an increase because there is this alpha that grows faster than the sine. So there's nothing special happening for Alice. Her time is running just smoothly. It's just no problem there. But we have this spike here in t because of that logarithm of w plus the tangent and w minus the tangent of alpha half. You see, when alpha is small, then the tangent is close to 0. So this is basically w over w, which is 1. And the logarithm of 1 is 0, so it's not contributing here, that term. And these terms are the only ones that contribute then. Then if alpha is pi half, then the tangent is very large. So then we have a very large tangent divided by minus very large tangent. So this becomes minus 1. The whole thing is minus 1. It have the absolute value of that. That's a plus 1 again. And so we have a 0 there. But we have one value here where we have w minus the tangent. And that can go to 0. Therefore, that goes to infinity. And when that goes to infinity, the log of this goes to infinity. And that's when this happens, when that spike happens. Anyway, it is clear that this coordinate system is really no good, because it looks like something dramatic is happening here when really there isn't. In any case, it's hard to see the light cones in this picture. Here, the light cone of Alice is basically this. But over there, the light cone of Alice is looking like that. This is, I mean, the forward light cone looks like this. And here, the forward light cone looks like that. And, you know, it goes like this eventually. So that eventually it would be harder and harder for Alice to escape, because her forward light cone becomes, you know, the right side of it becomes almost vertical then. Eventually becomes vertical, and then she's trapped in there. Okay, so there's got to be better coordinate systems. In order to arrive at them, let's first of all decide to drop the angular degrees of freedom. So we will only describe paths that are not moving in the angular variables. It's only radius and time that we will be considering. Okay, let's look at Alice's favorite coordinate system. How would Alice design a coordinate system? Alice says, I want that, first of all, the metric doesn't blow up at the horizon. Now, that's a very reasonable requirement because we said that there is no singularity at the horizon. So if there's no singularity, there better be a coordinate system that shows that everything is regular across the horizon. So that's a very reasonable requirement. Alice wants a coordinate system in which g mu nu of t and r will be the names of her time and radius variables, that will be other than the Schwarzschild time and radius. She wants that in the new variables, the g mu nu is regular across the horizon. But Alice wants more. She says, regular is good, but I want that g mu nu is actually eta mu nu at the horizon. Now, if there is no singularity at the horizon, then that should be possible. We know that we can always find, for example, Riemann normal coordinate system for which g mu nu is locally eta mu nu. And she wants more than that. She says, I want a coordinate system such that the metric is actually eta mu nu everywhere, except possibly for a scalar prefactor. That's not trivial that you can do that. But in 2D, and at the moment we are considering just the time and the radial variables, you can actually always do that because there is only a conformal degree of freedom in two dimensions. So Alice wants a coordinate system that's very, very nice. You see, this in particular will give her the ability to immediately draw all of the light cones because if the metric is everywhere proportional to eta mu nu, then you know that the light cones are always at 45 degrees. And the length of the vector, the actual length of the vectors, is affected by the scalar prefactor. But the question whether the length is a length squared is positive or negative, that's not going to be affected. And so therefore, you can immediately read off what the light cones are. And here are Alice's coordinates. They exist and they're called the Kruskal-Szekeres coordinates. So Alice has time capital T and radius capital R. And here is one hellish piece of a diffeomorphism. So it maps, this is the diffeomorphism that maps the coordinate system TR into the coordinate system capital T, capital R. So in principle, you can take this diffeomorphism and calculate the derivatives of capital T with respect to little t, with respect to little r, and so on, you get the Jacobi matrix. And then once you have the Jacobi matrix, you can calculate how the metric looks like. The Schwarzschild matrix, the Schwarzschild metric is transformed into the metric in these new coordinates by just applying twice the Jacobian matrix that you get by doing those derivatives. Obviously, that's a little tedious, but it's doable. And it turns out that with this specific diffeomorphism, you find that the metric takes this form, which is exactly the desired form. First of all, there is some scalar prefactor multiplying this part here, the dt squared minus dr squared, which is eta mu nu. Right? It's just the the temporal part and the spatial part with no relative factors in between. It's just eta mu nu, where the mu and the nu just run from 0 to 1 here. And I'm sorry, but we changed the signature such that in front of the time variable, we have now the plus sign. In front of the space variable, we have the minus sign. In previous lectures, we had it the other way around. So here we have a conformal prefactor, which looks not so bad, but actually it is pretty bad. It's very complicated because I didn't give you the full story here. I wrote here, among other things, like 2m is easy, but little r of tr is the Schwarzschild radius expressed in terms of Alice's time and radius. And in order to get that, you have to invert that diffeomorphism so that instead of having capital T and capital R in terms of little t and little r, no, now we want to have little r in terms of capital T and capital R, which is a super tedious thing to do. But if you do it, then you can plug it in here. You get this conformal prefactor times the Minkowski metric. So this obeys all the conditions that Alice posed on the coordinate system that she wanted. Namely, at the Schwarzschild radius, it is supposed to be exactly eta mu nu. Let's verify. At the Schwarzschild radius, r equal to 2m, this is 1. So we have e to the power of 1 minus 1 is e to the power 0 is 1. At the Schwarzschild radius, r is equal to 2m, so we have 2m divided by 2m. So the whole thing is just 1. And so at the Schwarzschild radius, the metric is really just dt squared minus dr squared, just eta mu nu. And then anywhere else, it is still a multiple of that. So that's super convenient. And here is now how the situation looks like for Alice in her coordinate system. So here we have the capital R variable, and we have the capital T variable. And Alice starts out here. This is the event that we had earlier here, that event here. That event here, so she starts at zero velocity at the radius r0. And that event is now here. So Alice is now falling towards the singularity of the black hole radially as before. In her coordinate system, because the metric is proportional to eta mu nu, all light cones look like this. All of them. Wherever you want to draw a light cone, it always looks like that. So Alice, in particular, is moving this way. So she's starting from r equals 0, t equals 0. R equals 0, t equals 0 is her starting point, traveling this way. I made a mistake. What we have now is Alice, for this new coordinate system, we have that the point at the origin that I showed you is not this point. It's the point up at infinity where she's actually falling into the black hole. So it's here. Right? So this is the event where she's crossing the event horizon. It's got to be like that because, you see, if she were here, she could still decide to travel this way and escape. But here, her forward light cone is just this. So she has no choice and she has to travel this way or that way or whatever. But traveling forward in time, she will eventually hit the singularity of the black hole. Notice that in her new coordinate system, the t variable is truly a time-like direction, always. And r is truly a space-like direction. And that's because, in her coordinate system, the metric is proportional to eta mu nu. So it's just like in Minkowski space. So in this coordinate system, maybe just to give you some more orientation here, a line of constant Schwarzschild time is this one. And that's a line of constant Schwarzschild time. That's a line of constant Schwarzschild time. And that's constant Schwarzschild time. And that's constant Schwarzschild time, and so on. All of these are constant Schwarzschild time. Constant Schwarzschild radius is this curve, for example, or that would be constant Schwarzschild radius. That is constant Schwarzschild radius, and this is constant Schwarzschild radius, and the singularity is constant Schwarzschild radius. An important thing to remember here is that this coordinate system is not any less fundamental than the previous one of Schwarzschild. In fact, it's kind of more plausible than the Schwarzschild one, because t is at least still a time-like variable, and r is still a space-like variable. Right, so Alice travels into the black hole like that. Maybe Alice has a friend with her, and that friend also travels into the black hole. That friend may start outside of the black hole and travel straight into the singularity. And then there's another friend of Alice who is a survivor who doesn't go into the black hole. And that friend is making use of the fact that the forward light cones look like this. That friend is deciding, well, I could go anywhere in this forward light cone. I could go into the black hole, but I can also go more vertically and in this way avoid going across the horizon. However, once anybody is in there, once Alice and her friends are in there, the only way forward, because the forward light cones are like that, is always hitting the singularity, no matter which way they are going. Notice what that means. It means that if a friend of Alice is here, then that friend has a choice. She can either go this way or that way. Well, or anywhere in between, right? But she can basically go this way or that way. And whether she travels in the one direction or in the opposite direction, none of the two directions is pointing outward. Both of the two directions are pointing inwards towards the singularity. So what we have here is that, for example, on this space-like hypersurface of constant r inside the black hole, we have that any geodesic that is forward-directed will hit the singularity, right? So, I mean, I'm emphasizing this because we might have the picture in mind that when you're inside the black hole, there's one direction, one spatial direction, which points towards the singularity, and the opposite direction points towards where I came from, where I may want to escape to. But that's not so. What we see here is that when you are on this space-like hypersurface and you look at your forward light cone, then yes, you have still two directions to choose, two opposite directions to choose, right? If you go this way or that way, that's all the directions you can choose, all of them point inward. And you can show that the expansion parameters sigma are negative, which means that if you have a congruence of geodesics on any one of those constant R space-like hypersurfaces, then the geodesics will be squished. And it doesn't matter in which direction you go. See, this is a very special, unusual, counterintuitive thing. If, for example, you consider instead of having a hypersurface of constant R inside a black hole, let us look at this hypersurface of constant R somewhere here in Minkowski space. So you just take a sphere, hypersurface of constant r, constant distance from some arbitrarily chosen origin of a coordinate system. So we take this hypersurface. And then we look at geodesics that either go inwards or opposite outwards. Right? So these are opposite directions. I can either go inwards or I can outwards. I can either go inwards or outwards in the RT diagram, in the radius time diagram, in the forward light cone. I'm either going left or right. Okay? So forward or backward. And then the geodesics, a congruence of geodesics that I make emanate from this sphere inwards, well, they will have a contraction. They will have that their sigmas are negative, right? So they will contract. Whereas when I have geodesics that point in the opposite direction, then they will expand. But what we have at the inside of a black hole and any one of those space-like hypersurfaces is that independently of whether you send your geodesics in one direction or the other, which would correspond in ordinary space to inwards or outwards, in either way, you're pointing towards the singularity, and you find when you calculate it that you have a contraction instead of an expansion. So the unusual thing is that geodesics in both directions would get contracted. That is a crucial ingredient in the proof of singularity theorems for black holes. Namely, they basically go like that. If you have a space-like hypersurface on which you have the geodesics, that the geodesics are being compressed both ways, what you might call outwards or inwards, or left and right, really, in this picture, if they get compressed in both ways, then that's a crucial ingredient for predicting that a singularity will occur.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Oh, but why should I expect the exterior social geometry to extend to inside? Why can't I like have another metric inside and then they just have a good matching condition at the event horizon? Like maybe the inside of the black hole is like an FRW metric.
Yes, absolutely. You can have that. You can always have some wild Schwarzschild solution. You can always have a Schwarzschild solution outside, and then inside you can have some other wild metric. You can have that.
Flat metric, I don't know.
Even flat metric, right. That's what you would have if you had an infalling shell, for example. Then you could have a Minkowski metric inside, and then outside you have something else. But what I was plotting here is the ordinary Schwarzschild black hole. This is not a sketch for everything that can happen, neutron stars or whatever, or some infalling shells. This is exactly the situation for a black hole, for a Schwarzschild black hole. Because remember, all we did is we took the Schwarzschild solution in the Schwarzschild coordinate, and then we applied a diffeomorphism in order to obtain the Schwarzschild solution in the Kruskal coordinate, in the Kruskal-Sekeres coordinate. So it's still the same space-time, exactly the same Lorentzian manifold. I'm just using a different coordinate system. So it's true, I could change the physical situation. And then, let's say, I could have the Schwarzschild coordinates here, the Schwarzschild metric here, and then the picture could change because inside it could be different. For example, the Earth has a Schwarzschild solution valid outside of its atmosphere. Right? So away from the Earth, in the vacuum of space, the way that the Earth is curving space is exactly a Schwarzschild solution. A little bit modified because Earth has angular momentum. Right. But then the Schwarzschild solution is modified where the matter starts, where the atmosphere is, and then where the rocks are, and water, and all of that. That changes it. So overall, it's not a Schwarzschild solution. But the vacuum outside Earth is, because of the symmetry principles, basically a Schwarzschild solution. Right, so for Schwarzschild, we have this. Also, in case you have not seen that, it is very useful sometimes, especially for quantum field theory. So it won't be our concern in this course, but in the next year's course on quantum field theory in curved space-time, it will be important. That it is quite useful sometimes to move from ordinary coordinates, where one variable is time and the other one is radius or space, to so-called light cone coordinates, which are obtained by adding and subtracting the two variables. And why would we want to do this? Didn't we do enough diffeomorphisms? Wasn't that complicated enough? Well, it turns out that if you do this, if you introduce a new coordinate system, little u, little v, obtained by adding and subtracting the previous two variables, then in this new coordinate system, the metric still just has a conformal prefactor, and then it still has the eta metric, but in these new coordinates, it looks like this. It is linear in du and linear in dv. And why would we want that? Well, it's because then it becomes much easier to describe matter fields living on space-time. In particular, if the matter field is a Klein-Gordon field, then remember the Klein-Gordon action can be written like this. Jason explained this to you. So in terms of Alice's Kruskal-Szekeres variables, you have the second time derivative squared minus the second space derivative squared. That is the action that gives you the Lagrangian, and then integrated you get the action in Alice's coordinate system. But then if you change variables to the u and v variables, to the light cone variables, then a little transformation shows that the action now becomes an action where you simply have d by du of phi times d by dv of phi. So it's no longer the sum of two squares, but it's just linear in them. And that means that the equation of motion becomes simply this. And differential equations of that type are very well known, and it's super easy to solve them.
But this one is only true in two dimensions, right?
That's like right.
In four dimensions, you have mass, effective mass term.
That's right. Yes, we neglected that here. That's right. Okay, now, let's say there's a Bob too, and Bob also gets to choose a coordinate system. But Bob is more afraid of the black holes. He's not much of an adventurer. He stays far away. And so let's say Bob is far away from the black hole, and he wants to have a nice coordinate system for himself. So he imposes the reasonable request that the metric should become eta mu nu out there where he lives, at very large radius. Okay. So basically, he knows that the solution far away is Minkowski space. I better get the Minkowski metric in my coordinate system. So he wants a coordinate system that behaves like that. Alice doesn't have that. Alice doesn't have, at very far radii, Minkowski space. No, she has eta mu nu times a scalar prefactor. And that scalar prefactor is non-trivial for large distances. I don't remember whether it blows up or goes to zero, but it behaves non-trivially there, depending on what is r, what is t, and so on. So Bob wants that the metric becomes the Minkowski metric. Or I shouldn't say the metric itself, because remember, we are tying here the choices of basis vectors in the tangent spaces to the choice of coordinate system. And so when I say the metric becomes this or the metric becomes that, no, it's the shape that the metric takes, right? So technically, Bob is searching for a coordinate system such that the metric tensor takes this form asymptotically far out. And Bob is also requiring, since he knew that Alice got away with it, Bob is requiring that the metric is a multiple of eta mu nu everywhere. You might say, well, that's some modest request. That should be doable. And Bob says, yes, yes, that is very doable. Should be possible and should be very desirable. Because in particular, because he maintained that request that also Alice had, in his coordinate system, again, the forward light cones can be immediately drawn because they will still be at 45 degrees because the metric is still just eta mu nu times the scalar prefactor. And very far out, we have the ordinary interpretation of Minkowski space. If you are very far away from the black hole, this coordinate system becomes the coordinate system of Minkowski space.
I want to clarify something. So this relationship, the second one, which is that the G mu nu is formally equivalent to Minkowski metric, you are actually really talking about just the TR sector of the metric.
That's correct. That's correct. In four dimensions, that's not always that's not always possible. That's right. But keep in mind that in two dimensions, even though it looks like the metric has 4 degrees of freedom, the metric really has only one. And the counting works like this. The metric is a 2x2 matrix that has 4 entries. But because it's symmetric, the 1-2 entry is the same as the 2-1 entry. So that leaves us with 3. And now you can still apply a diffeomorphism, which gives you 2 free functions, because it's 2 coordinates. And so you can fix 2 of your entries of the metric everywhere, generically to be whatever value you want them to be. That gives you 1 degree of freedom. And so in two dimensions, curvature is rather a rather poor structure. It has only 1 degree of freedom. But in more dimensions, it has more.
So I just have to be careful that the mu nu is only 0, 1.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so Bob's wishes can be fulfilled, and the coordinate system is the so-called tortoise coordinate system that Bob would use. How does space-time look like for him then? In terms of the Schwarzschild coordinates, turns out his time is Schwarzschild time. That tells us a lot already. It tells us that in his coordinate system, it will take Alice an infinite amount of his kind of time to cross the horizon. Okay, so Bob can have his wishes, and T star is T, the Schwarzschild time. Now, how is Bob's radius expressed in terms of the Schwarzschild radius? Well, it's expressed in terms of the Schwarzschild radius like this. It's r minus 2m plus this expression here with a logarithm. And a crucial observation here is that this logarithm needs the argument to be positive, which means that r has to be larger than 2m. Which means that this coordinate system only works outside the Schwarzschild horizon. So the tortoise coordinates, the coordinate system that Bob won, the one that is proportional to eta mu nu and reduces to the Minkowski metric far out, that coordinate system is only good until the Schwarzschild horizon. Now, outside the Schwarzschild horizon, though, this diffeomorphism is invertible. So what diffeomorphism? Well, it's a map from R2 into R2, from R2 into a subset of R2. You know, it's from the variables TR to the variables T star, R star. That diffeomorphism is invertible, but only if R is larger than 2m. And you can do the usual exercise if you want to know how the Schwarzschild metric looks like in the new coordinates, in Bob's tortoise coordinates. Then you need to calculate the Jacobian matrix that comes with this diffeomorphism, and then multiply to the metric twice, contract the indices, simplify the terms, and find out what the metric looks like. And that's the answer. So the metric is expressed as a scalar prefactor, as required, times the Minkowski type of metric, where the scalar prefactor, again, looks like it's simple, but it is actually pretty messy. And the reason is that I wrote here little r of r star. In order to find out what the Schwarzschild radius is as a function of the tortoise radius, you need to invert that relationship. Well, this one is trivial, but that one. Now try to solve this for little r. Right? This is super tedious. I don't think it can be done. There's no closed solution for this. You can show that it exists. There's a monotonic relationship between them. So you can invert that. But I don't think a closed solution can be given to this. In any case, you can write it like that. And let's quickly check that all the requirements are fulfilled. Bob wanted that his new coordinate system is such that the metric is always proportional to the Minkowski eta, and that's certainly true because that's the scalar prefactor here. But also, he wanted that for very large distances away from the black hole, it just becomes the Minkowski metric, and that happens because then R is very large, so that term goes away, and so we have that. But on the other hand, we can ask, what does his metric look like when we approach the horizon? It becomes eta mu nu when we are far away from the horizon, but when, as we approach the horizon, as R approaches 2m from above, we see that this becomes 1 from below, so that gets smaller and smaller from the positive side, and at the horizon it would be 0. So basically this formulation, this coordinate system is such that the metric fizzles out at the horizon, goes to 0. But that's of course, it doesn't mean that physically something bad happens there, as for example Alice's coordinate system shows. It just means that this coordinate system is not good at the horizon itself, because the metric goes to 0. It would no longer be invertible. So the coordinate system ends before the horizon is reached.
Actually, I have a question about that one. So when your metric degenerates to 0, right?
Yeah.
Can you conclude just from that alone that the event horizon is a null hypersurface? Or you have to do something that is more geometric than that to prove?
I think you have to do more than that. Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason is that I think you can probably...
Because in Schwarzschild solution,
yeah,
they coincide. Like.
Yes. Actually, you may be able to do it, yes. That's right. Yes. Because you could just take a tangent vector and then check whether it is light-like or not. And you can do that in any coordinate system. And you can do it in this coordinate system and then say that...
Yeah, so in this case, yeah, because right. ES square becomes 0 at that point, then you...
Yeah, good point. Yeah, but strictly speaking, you can't.
Yes, strictly speaking.
You can't because the coordinate system is simply not valid there, because the metric is not invertible. It's just as bad that it goes to 0 that if it were to go to infinity.
It's just coincident because there's only one null hypersurface in whole spacetime.
Mm. So, how does it look like now? How does the situation look like to Bob now? Well, his coordinate system has, again, that R star is strictly a space-like coordinate, and T star is strictly a time-like coordinate, and there's no swap between time-likeness and space-likeness. But that's not much to the credit of Bob's coordinate system, because Bob's coordinate system doesn't even extend to the inside of the black hole. So the question doesn't really come up. You see, T star is the Schwarzschild time. So it would be prone to a flip of sign, but we only use it up to the horizon, but not inside the horizon. Now, the light cones are always looking like this. Wherever you look, they always look like that. The variable R star, so the radius for Bob, actually goes all the way to minus infinity. All the way to minus infinity. And that's how the horizon looks like for Bob. Bob will say that if you travel in his coordinate system towards the horizon, you will never reach it. Yes, you can travel at 45 degrees towards the horizon, but it's infinitely far away. Therefore, it takes you an infinite amount of time t star, which is an infinite amount of Schwarzschild time to reach it. So now the horizon is all the way over there for Bob. Bob too can choose now light cone variables. So he can choose to move from a coordinate system t star r star to coordinate system u bar and v bar obtained by taking the sum and the difference of the two previous variables. And again, the metric takes the interesting form that it has a scalar prefactor. And then instead of having dt squared minus dr star squared, it has this form where it is just linear in the two of them. And that is useful because the action, for example, the Klein-Gordon action, then simplifies from the usual kind of Klein-Gordon action where you have second time derivative minus second space derivative to this Klein-Gordon action, which leads to Euler-Lagrange equations, to the Klein-Gordon equation taking that simple form. Now, here in this course, we're not really doing anything with that, but I wanted to show it to you because Alice's coordinate system and her light cone version of it, light cone coordinate system version of it, on one hand, and Bob's coordinate system and his light cone coordinate version of his coordinate system are exactly the kind of coordinate system which are inviting to do the quantization of the field theory. So basically, from here, it would be very quick that we could derive Hawking radiation, because we would study the vacuum from the perspective of Alice. What is the vacuum from the perspective of Bob? And then a few arguments later, we would show that there are Bogoliubov transformations that give us Hawking radiation. We'll do it next term if you come along. Okay, however, how about real black holes, such as this one? See, all I told you so far was about a black hole that certainly doesn't exist. It's a Schwarzschild black hole, completely symmetric. It has no charge, it doesn't even rotate. For sure, there's no such thing in the universe. And so the question then is, how realistic is this? We do have pretty good evidence that there are black holes, such as this one, but do they have singularities? Let me say a few things about this. At the center of our galaxy is Sagittarius A star. Obviously, it's not the bright spot there. It's a dark spot, but it's where the bright spots are. And its data are that it has about 4 million stellar masses, diameter of about 44 million kilometers, which is...
Can you say 44 million kilometers? Who measures that?
Are you measuring it?
No, I'm not measuring it, so I know how to do it.
Yeah, it's being measured now, as we speak. But think about it this way. The sun, for example, has a Schwarzschild radius of a few kilometers, like 3.4 kilometers or something, like 4 kilometers or something, right? And the Schwarzschild radius is proportional to the mass. This black hole has 4 million stellar masses, which we know because of the trajectories of stars around that black hole. And that means that its Schwarzschild radius must be so many times larger than the Schwarzschild radius of the sun.
No, I mean,
so it's basically millions of solar masses, so it must be a million times longer.
Like if your hockey stick is 1 meter long, would that correspond to a certain number of your hockey sticks if you were to measure that distance? Like what ruler are you using?
Oh, right. Yeah, we shouldn't think of the radius of a black hole as something that's being measured by having hockey sticks lined up from the singularity all the way to the horizon. Because obviously, can't do that, right? And in any case, the radial variable is not a space-like coordinate, a time-like coordinate. No, by radius, we generally mean the Schwarzschild radius in the sense of the value of the Schwarzschild coordinate.
So that doesn't necessarily correspond.
It doesn't correspond to that. However, I think, if I remember correctly, it is simply related to the area of a sphere that you could build around the black hole and then get closer and closer to the horizon and have that, it's like a metal construction of a sphere, and you measure its area, and that's a well-defined thing you can do, made out of rods, and then you make that approach the horizon, and then you define the radius as that quantity, which is like 4 pi r squared should be the area, right? And then if you define a radius like that, I think it coincides with the Schwarzschild radius. But it just happens to be that there's no reason otherwise to say that. Because you're right, it's not a radius per se. Yeah. Yeah, it's about 26,000 light years away from us, pretty much at the center of the Milky Way. The Milky Way itself is on the order of, I think, 200,000 light years in diameter, even though dark matter seems to be spread out a little bit further than that. Observations have been made this year and past year, I guess, and I think they were concluded in July, is that right?
The first observation was done in April, and the second one was done in August.
All right.
Yeah.
Right, and now you're processing it, right?
Yep.
Yes. Okay, great. And then the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration is supposed to, if you work hard enough,
yep.
is supposed to come up with a picture of what we don't see here, a picture of hopefully the actual blackness of a black hole. Now, are you working in a millimeter band, right?
Yes, 1.3.
1.3 millimeters, right. Yes, and as far as I know, please correct me if I'm wrong, the Event Horizon Telescope is also looking, is not just looking at Sagittarius A, but also at the black hole in one of the neighboring galaxies.
Yeah,
M87.
Yeah.
Thanks. And M87 is quite a distance away from us, much further away than 26,000 light years. But their black hole is so much more massive that it has almost the same opening angle, almost the same size for us from our perspective. So that's, I mean, it's always good to have more than one thing you can test, right? I mean, one experiment is just give you a sample size of one.
But for the M87, the main problem is the hotspot. Starting where the hotspot goes and how they start hotspot and how they go in the accretion disk. They're not really looking to the event horizon for M87 because it's kind of so far away.
Oh.
Yeah.
What are they looking at then?
Not really.
Where are you looking at with it then?
So the hotspot, the accretion disk, the hotspot accretion disk, and the filament.
So you're like measuring the ISCO, like the innermost or?
Not even that. Just hotspot.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, you do what you can. Let us tell us what you tell us what you find. I find it super exciting. By the way, have you all seen this? I should have prepared it. But there is a video of stars going around Sagittarius A.
Yeah, yeah.
It's super cool. It's like one frame a month or something, and you see how a star is coming along like this, and then as it comes close to the black hole, it goes like vroom. And you can tell whatever it swung around must have been way heavier than itself, because it's like accelerating like this. It's very, very nice. Right, so how can one model the properties then of real black holes? Obviously, without being able to solve the problem entirely, how can we do it roughly? So singularity theorems, which are suitable for black holes, involve the concept and the assumption of the validity of the assumption that there are trapped surfaces. So I mentioned that already a little bit in the pictures previously. Let sigma be a space-like hypersurface. So a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface. Now imagine that T is a compact two-dimensional smooth space-like submanifold of sigma. So imagine sigma to be like a snapshot in time, because you're looking at a space-like hypersurface, like a snapshot in time. Now let us look at T, a subset of sigma, which is itself a compact two-dimensional smooth space-like submanifold. So you can think of sigma as being like a black hole at a point in time, a space-like hypersurface, I should say, because point in time, you know, you have to be very careful what time is. And then T could be, for example, one of those hypersurfaces, two-dimensional hypersurfaces of constant Schwarzschild radius R. Remember the picture? No, I went too far. Right. So you could have that sigma is all of the inside of the black hole, for example. You take like all of this, all of these space-like. So for constant T, you get a space-like hypersurface. So you take, for example, this constant R hypersurface. And we were talking about how geodesics will contract, no matter whether you sent them off this way, they will contract, or sent them off that way, they will contract, because both directions that you could travel radially, both directions that you could travel will lead towards a singularity, will make things crush. So now, okay, so sigma is a space-like hypersurface, and T is a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface. T is a compact, two-dimensional, smooth, space-like submanifold of sigma, such as a hypersphere of a two-dimensional sphere of constant radius, Schwarzschild radius. Now, consider the ingoing and the outgoing future-directed null geodesics that are orthogonal to T. So you are on, you cross the horizon, you're on the way to the singularity, and you have two directions, one of which you might think of as ingoing, one of them you might think of as outgoing, but as we showed, both lead to the singularity. And in both directions, you can now consider the future-directed null geodesics. So you send light towards, in one direction towards the singularity, and you turn around and you send light again in the opposite direction now, but it also ends up at the singularity. So you're looking at the ingoing and outgoing future-directed null geodesics that are orthogonal to T, to my surface of constant Schwarzschild radius. And really, ingoing and outgoing is a little confusing here, because if you look at the picture, it's just a matter of left and right, but you're still heading towards a singularity anyway. So there's no way of telling what you should call ingoing and what you should tell outgoing. It's just this expression is inherited from the picture outside the black hole, where if you take a sphere around the black hole, then the geodesics that emanate from a constant R surface, from a constant R sphere, the geodesics can be divided into geodesics of light that goes outwards, and the geodesics move away from each other, and geodesics that move inwards from the sphere, and they would move towards each other. But if you look at a constant R surface inside the black hole, then no matter whether you send the light one direction or the other direction, they will always converge. So if all these geodesics, whether they go one way or the opposite direction, if all those geodesics possess negative expansion, sigma smaller than zero, then we call T a trapped surface. Because you're kind of trapped if you're there. So an example is all of the R equal constant surfaces inside of a Schwarzschild black hole. Not that you could see that here. It's not obvious from this picture. It's not supposed to be visible why the geodesics, why a congruence of geodesics would necessarily have to converge. You'd have to calculate what the sigma is to see that. So that's the this is the picture for a Schwarzschild black hole, where this picture is obtained in Alice's coordinate system. It's an exact Schwarzschild black hole. But what can we say about the generic case? So let us look at the generic situation of a realistic black hole that actually formed, such as Sagittarius A. Now let's look at a Penrose diagram of it. So we've shrunk everything to finite size through conformal transformations. Now imagine that the black hole formed because there was a shell of material that fell in, or a star that collapsed. Then the diagram looks like this. If it's just a shell, which is hollow, then we have a line, a world line, that tells us where in space, this is the space direction, this is the time direction. So this line tells us where in space and in time the shell was, the radius of the shell. So if it was a hollow shell that collapsed to form a black hole, then this is the trajectory of the hollow shell. If, more realistically, it was a star that collapsed, or a huge gas cloud, or something made out of dark matter, or whatever, then I would have to shade this in, because then all the radii are occupied with matter from zero all the way to the boundary of it. So this could either be just a hollow shell, or it could be a filled 3D object. This is how it looks like when it initially just evolves. And then it eventually collapses. Keep in mind that the fact that this is a curved thing doesn't tell you anything about the dynamics of the star. Because even if you were to just sit at some place and not move, you would have a curve like that. A geodesic looks like this. And that's because of the conformal transformation that gave us the Penrose diagram. We have that geodesics generally are not straight lines. What are straight lines are geodesics of light, but everything else is not straight lines. So a collapsing star would be described by the inside of all of this as time evolves. And then the star collapses, and eventually it disappears behind its Schwarzschild horizon. That would be the Schwarzschild horizon. And here's the singularity. We discussed that earlier. And here is an event on one of those R equal constant surfaces of the inside of a black hole. And here now, if you're part of that collapsing star, you could say, oh, I'm sending light outwards. Which direction should I point it? Which direction should I point my flashlight so that the light goes outwards? Well, no luck, because independently of which direction you point the light, it will either go this way towards the singularity or that way towards the singularity, but you can't escape it because you can't go shallower than 45 degrees. That's why we have the horizon here. So in the general picture, you can again have in here space-like hypersurfaces, compact space-like hypersurfaces on which the expansion is negative in all directions. in which case you have trapped surfaces up here. And again, there's no way really to tell from that picture that you would have, that the geodesics necessarily have, that they are contracting, that the expansion parameters are negative. You'd have to calculate that. Or you make the assumption that it is happening. So now let sigma be a space-like hypersurface. Then the three-dimensional space-like union tau of all the trapped surfaces inside is called the trapped region of sigma. Okay, so sigma is a space-like hypersurface, a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface, a kind of snapshot of your universe. Then you look at three-dimensional space-like, then you look within sigma, within that snapshot, you look at all trapped surfaces which are part of sigma, all trapped surfaces tau, all two-dimensional compact surfaces on which the expansion parameters are negative. And then you look at the collection of all those trapped surfaces. So in the case of a Schwarzschild black hole, we would have that for every radius inside the black hole, we have one of those trapped surfaces. If we now take the collection of all of them, then that is a trapped, that's the trapped region of sigma. And then we can look at the boundary of this set of trapped surfaces, the boundary of the trapped region. That is called the apparent horizon. That's basically where it starts. That if you come from an ordinary region of space-time and you hit the apparent horizon, the moment you hit the apparent horizon is the moment when it no longer matters whether you send your geodesics this way or the opposite way, they will always contract. Normally, you send them one way and they will contract, and then if you send them the other way, they will expand. But as soon as they hit the apparent horizon, it doesn't matter anymore. So then if we foliate space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, sigma, so we consider many snapshots, space-time, then each of those snapshots has its apparent horizon, let's call it tau alpha. So each snapshot in time, each space-like hypersurface, that's sigma alpha. And then for each one of them, we look at the boundary of the collection of its trapped surfaces. So we have an apparent horizon for each one of those snapshots. And we can look at the union of all those apparent horizons. And that is the so-called trapping horizon of the space-time. How does that compare now to an event horizon? Remember that if we wanted to check for the existence of an event horizon, we have to do that on the basis of the knowledge of all future. If we want to know whether an observer has an event horizon, and remember that the definition of event horizon is relative to a choice of an observer. So if an observer has an event horizon, we have to know all of the future of that observer. We have to look at the timeline of this observer all the way to future time like infinity, and then look at the causal past of that observer, and then the boundary of the causal past of that observer, if it exists, is the event horizon of that observer. And a key problem with this definition is that we never know of anything the complete future. And so the notion of event horizon is a teleological principle, is a teleological concept that requires global information, not local. Therefore, the definition of apparent horizon has obvious advantages here. It's not a matter that it's not a race between the two. Just saying that apparent horizons, in contrast to event horizons, are things that you can calculate right away at the time. So you can check for the existence of an apparent horizon in any space like hypersurface. So you take a snapshot in time, and then you look at the compact space like two-dimensional hypersurfaces and check whether or not they are trapped. And then look at the union of them and check what the boundary of them is. And then you get the apparent horizon. And all of that you can do by just calculating what the expansion parameters are in each of the directions. And if they come out negative, then all negative, then you have found an apparent horizon. So you might think, okay, that's a much better definition than event horizon. And it is, in many regards, a better definition. But it has some weirdness to it, too, the definition of apparent horizons. And that's because the notion of apparent horizon, while not being dependent on the choice of observer and being dependent on the knowledge of what this observer will do forever, or where that observer will travel forever, it is dependent, the notion of apparent horizons is relative to a choice of space-like hypersurfaces. It's relative to your choice of how you foliate space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. How do you define your snapshots of space-time? You know, you can foliate space-time in many different ways. And once you've made your choice of how you foliate space-time, then for every point in time, you have a space-like hypersurface, and then you can look at the two-dimensional compact space-like surfaces and check whether or not they are trapped, etc., etc. But this is relative to your foliation. And it turns out, for example, that you can foliate a Schwarzschild black hole space-time in such a way that there's no apparent horizon. So that's a little weird. That would be a very weird way of choosing your foliation, but it is possible. A few more comments. For Schwarzschild black holes, it so happens that the event horizon and the apparent horizons coincide. But in general, they don't coincide. Now, singularity theorems for black holes, for black hole singularities that predict the existence of black hole singularities from very generic assumptions, usually make as one of those assumptions that there are trapped surfaces, that there are apparent horizons. Basically, what they're saying is that if you have these trapped surfaces, if it so happens that geodesics contract no matter which direction you send them off, then that will lead to a singularity. A final comment. Hawking radiation is usually thought to come not from an event horizon, but to come from the apparent horizon. All right? That's as far as we get today. Yeah?
You were saying that apparent horizon depends on your choice of foliation, right?
Mm.
But does that mean it is still intrinsic quantity of space-time?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's just that, I mean, for example, you can foliate space-time into space-like hypersurfaces and then calculate things like intrinsic and extrinsic curvature. And these things are definitely properties of the space-time, and yet they do depend on how you slice.
Why the second, the last comment? Why the Hawking radiation?
Okay, now that you ask. Okay. There's a huge controversy about this. Most people would subscribe to the idea that, yes, the Hawking radiation comes from the apparent horizon rather than the event horizon. However, that would seem to have some dramatic consequences, because what if the apparent horizon is inside the event horizon? how is Hawking radiation supposed to come out then? And there was, I was at a conference on black holes where George Ellis of Hawking and Ellis' book made the point that realistic black holes are always growing black holes. Like the galactic black holes, stellar black holes, they're always growing because their Hawking temperature is so low that they absorb much more than they can radiate away. They absorb, at minimum, cosmic microwave background radiation, which is at like 3 Kelvin. And the temperature, the Hawking temperature of a stellar or galactic black hole is way, way colder than that. So these black holes grow. And for growing black holes, the apparent horizon is space-like. And according to quantum field theoretical calculations, you can argue that that should mean that if you view Hawking radiation as arising from a tunneling process through the horizon, it should be suppressed. It should be impossible because it would be acausal. On the other hand, if a black hole is shrinking, so you keep it away from all sources of heat or other radiation, if a black hole is shrinking, then that's not a problem. And in fact, the radiation should be enhanced because it's time-like. The apparent horizon is time-like. Only for Schwarzschild black holes, it is light-like because it's constant in size, the black hole, right? And so some people agreed with this, and some people disagreed, and some people said there are no black holes, and some people said there is no Hawking radiation anyway, and there's very little agreement on, on Hawking radiation. I think what one needs to keep in mind in all those considerations is the wavelength of black hole radiation. Because it's all good and fine to argue about where Hawking radiation emanates from. Does it come from the event horizon or from the apparent horizon? They might be a millimeter apart from each other or whatever, right? But what is the typical wavelength of Hawking radiation? As we will calculate next term, the typical wavelength of Hawking radiation is expected to be the Schwarzschild radius. Which is, by the way, why they are so cold. You see, when you have heat radiation of a wavelength of several kilometers, or in the case of a galactic-sized black hole, the Hawking radiation has a typical wavelength of millions of kilometers, then clearly it is very cold. You see, the heat radiation that comes from the sun is at 6,000 Kelvin. And we know where the peak radiation is. It's in the green, which is like, what is it, 400 nanometers or something? Right? That's the wavelength, typical wavelength 400 nanometers, which means that you would need a black hole whose Schwarzschild radius is like 400 nanometers in order to radiate with the color of the sun. And the realistic black holes are way, way too big. And way, way bigger, and therefore their Schwarzschild radiation is much more longer wavelength. And what that also means is that it's not clear whether it makes sense to distinguish between, you know, the Hawking radiation emanating from the apparent horizon or event horizon if the wavelength itself is so big. Right? It's as big as the black hole itself. So the whole thing is still a complete mystery. We do know some things. We know what happens if you straightforwardly just put together the what we know from quantum field theory and what we know from general relativity. Then you get Hawking radiation. You get the generating of fluctuations in early universe cosmology. These are the things that we're going to calculate next term. But then, fundamentally, what the quantum theory is of gravity itself, so not just fields that live on spacetime, but if you actually allow spacetime itself to quantum fluctuate, well, then opinions diverge as much as integrals in particle physics. Yeah. Yeah, I think everything is still up in the air. It is possible that quantum effects of space-time itself, of curvature, might completely invalidate the idea of Hawking radiation existing, or it might completely validate the idea. There may or may not be actual singularities. Nobody knows these things for sure. I think we can learn a lot from just quantum field theory in curved space, but it's just preliminary.
How about the cosmological constant? Because if I put cosmological constant to be, say, positive, right, which is in the case of accelerating universe,
yeah,
right, then my Penrose diagram wouldn't be that diamond shape, right? Because
yeah,
my sky plus would be time-like. It's space-like. I forgot.
Mm.
So would that affect how you perceive Hawking radiation? Because now your radiation is like observer-dependent.
Yes, it is, but I wouldn't consider that to be a fundamental problem. But what can happen is that, you see, when space-time expands, then, for example, space-time is of course expanding under our feet. And in particular, galaxies are drifting apart. So how about the Earth and the Sun? Aren't they drifting apart? Well, in principle, they are. It's just that they're tightly bound, and so we don't notice. But if there was a cosmological constant that's really, really strong, then not only would galaxies move apart from each other, actually, solar system and galaxies would themselves be expanded and drifted apart because the binding forces would be weaker than the freeing force of the expansion of space-time underneath. And if the cosmological constant was really very strong, then even the solar system would be ripped apart. Because as the Earth goes around the Sun, more and more space is being created between the Sun and the Earth. And, you know, it would no longer be tightly bound. Eventually, it would all fall apart. And similarly, with a black hole, you could, in principle, imagine that the black hole would be prevented from forming. Or if it formed, it might even unform because of a huge expansion. Everything might be ripped apart. That is a possibility. But this has been studied. I mean, black hole solutions with cosmological constants, yeah, you get that sort of thing happening. But coming back to your original question, I think that the local physics of the neighborhood of the black hole, in principle, usually can be decoupled from the asymptotic physics of far away. Except if the cosmological constant is really strong, then yeah, everything mixes up. More questions? All right.